Hello and welcome to Science World. On November 5th, India will head to Mars when it launches an unmanned spacecraft that should reach the red planet by next September. A study released this past week has identified a weather pattern in the atmosphere that may help meteorologists better predict the onset of dangerous and deadly heat waves. There are people in parts of the world who don't get to see the sun much, especially in wintertime, when days are short and the nights are long. A town in Norway has come up with a unique way to keep the sun shining on their town. And researchers in North Carolina this week announced that they found that brain cells that most thought only served as a kind of a wiring system do a lot more than that by actually boosting the brain's computing power. This and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. India will launch a spacecraft to Mars on November 5th, an ambitious feat attempted by only a handful of countries. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, the mission to the Red Planet marks a major expansion of India's space program as it tries to emerge on the front lines of space exploration.
Its destination Mars on Tuesday. As the day approaches, there is a mounting sense of anticipation among scientists at the space station in Sriharikota on India's east coast, from where the unmanned spacecraft will be launched. The Mars Orbiter mission will be the country's first interplanetary mission. Spokesman of the Indian Space Research Organization, Devi Prasad Karnik, says the main challenge is for the spacecraft to successfully enter the Mars orbit by September of next year.
The primary objective is to demonstrate the technical capability of India to reach Mars and then conduct a meaningful science experiment. The whole country is looking forward to it.
That is not surprising. Despite much advancement in space technology, a mission to Mars is still a challenge. Only about one-third have been successful. The 1,350-kilogram craft, equipped with five instruments, will study the surface, topography and atmosphere. In particular, it will look for evidence of methane, whose presence can indicate if Earth's closest neighbor has an environment to support life. If successful, India will be the fourth to survey the planet from up close, besides Russia, the United States and the European Space Agency. India's Mars orbiter will be launched 2 weeks before the United States also sends another spacecraft to Mars. India's program has been put together in a relatively short period, about 4 years. Several analysts feel rivalry with the other Asian giant, China, whose space program is ahead of India's, gave momentum to the mission. Dean Cheng at the Heritage Foundation in Washington says India is taking advantage of an opportunity provided by the failure of China's first mission to Mars in 2011.
The failure of the Chinese expedition to Mars, I think, has given India an opportunity to publicly display its capability and, in a sense, to play one-upmanship with China. So I think that this particular mission is being moved ahead at this moment in time to make sure that India can show the world that India's space capabilities are not necessarily that far behind China's.
Senior Indian scientists, however, have said they're not in a race with anybody, only with themselves to excel. India's Mars mission does mark a major expansion of the country's space program as it sets its eyes firmly on space exploration. The first such bid came in 2008 when it sent an unmanned craft to the moon. There has been some criticism of India's Mars program as an unnecessary extravagance by a country which still needs to do much to improve the life of millions of poor people. For long, India has justified its space program as one which does exactly that, by focusing on areas such as weather forecasting and using satellites to beam education programs to remote areas. India points to the relatively modest budget for the mission, $70 million. They say that is a fraction of what the US mission will be costing. Dean Cheng says India is willing to commit significant resources to its space program. He says besides technological and scientific objectives, the Mars mission is linked to national prestige and a desire by India to be counted among the world's up-and-coming countries.
Assuming that all goes well, India will be joining a very small, very select group. This is India's, in a sense, coming out party, if you will, certainly in terms of space exploration.
That is what India will be hoping, that its coming out party in space goes off without a hitch. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Heat waves are the most deadly weather phenomenon on Earth and, like other extreme weather events, are difficult to predict. Roseanne Skirbel tells us that a new study has identified a weather pattern in the atmosphere that just might help meteorologists improve their forecasts and, as a result, save lives.
Heat waves are big killers. Across Europe in 2003, heat waves were blamed for 50,000 deaths. 600 lives were lost in California in 2006 because of the scorching temperatures. Researchers have struggled to find ways to help forecasters better predict the onset of a heat wave.
Previously, we have put most of our focus on the tropics or land surface, sea surface conditions to look for sources that may provide subseasonal predictability.
Climate scientist Haiyan Tan has turned her attention to the atmosphere to identify circulation patterns that precede heat waves. She and colleagues at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, ran a 12,000-year computer simulation over the Northern Hemisphere.
And instead of just 30 events from the last 50 years of observations, we got like 6,000 of extreme heat wave events. This gave us enough samples to study the precursor circulation patterns for these heat waves.
The computer model identified a pattern that showed up before the temperature rose. It's characterized by a sequence of alternating high and low pressure systems, five of each circling the northern latitudes.
It's high above the atmosphere in the upper troposphere, and this pattern turned to lead the U.S. heat waves by 2 weeks.
While the pattern is well documented in the historic record, this is the first time it's been connected to extreme heat waves. When the scientists reviewed real heat waves in the United States dating back to 1948, a similar pattern often emerged.
So we think, okay, this pattern is a pattern in nature, and it is useful for the heat wave probability forecast. It is an estimate of the probability, not exactly how warm the temperature is going to be like.
Ten says the wave pattern described in the journal Nature Geoscience is global in scale and has implications beyond the Northern Hemisphere. While more research needs to be done to confirm the findings, Ten says her team will continue their search for other circulation and environmental factors that foreshadow extreme weather. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
It's time once again for the Science World Quick Quiz. Roseanne Skirbel just told us about new research that may help forecasters better predict heat waves. So, speaking of heat waves and hot weather, what, according to the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society, was the highest temperature ever recorded on Earth? Was it A, 60 degrees, B, 53.5 degrees, or C, 56.7 degrees all Celsius? Think about it and see if you can come up with the right answer. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Scientists have discovered differences in the brain structure of ballet dancers that may help them avoid dizziness while whirling around the stage and performing pirouettes. The findings could lead to the development of dance therapy for patients suffering from chronic dizziness. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us more.
Researchers at Imperial College London have studied brains of dancers who can perform multiple spins with very little or no feeling of dizziness. A team led by neurologist Barry Seemungle compared 29 female dancers with 29 female rowers of the same age range and fitness levels. The brains in the two groups reacted differently after being spun around in a dark room.
When we correlated dizziness sensation to the white matter structure, in non-dancers, we found a very strong correlation between how dizzy you were and the strength of a white matter network in the cerebral cortex, which is the part of the brain we use to sense and perceive things. In the dancers, we did not find this correlation.
Normally, the feeling of dizziness stems from the vestibular organs in the inner ear. These fluid-filled chambers sense rotation of the head through tiny hairs that detect the fluid moving. After turning around rapidly, the fluid continues to move, which can make you feel like you're still spinning. MRI brain scans revealed differences in two parts of the brain, an area in the cerebellum where sensory input from the vestibular organs is processed, and in the cerebral cortex, which is responsible for the perception of dizziness.
It demonstrates to us that the brain is a very plastic organ, and what happens to it is heavily dependent on what you do. And so with years of training, the brain remodels itself into a form that becomes quite resistant to dizziness.
Dance student Claire Haven, who took part in the study, says dancers learn how to spin gradually. With a technique called spotting and with lots of practice, they learn to perform multiple pirouettes without feeling dizzy.
It's something that you're taught how to do. It's not something that's natural. So from a young age in ballet class, you run around, pretend to be a fairy, you're just turning around on the spot. Then as you get older, you're taught what spotting is, so you whip your head round. As you get older, you practice where your balance is.
Dr. Seemungal, who runs a specialist clinic for dizziness at London's Charing Cross Hospital, says if dance therapy proves to be helpful to patients with chronic dizziness, it could be done in large groups and practiced at home. He says such therapy would be much less expensive than current individual treatments. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
A town in Norway known for its winter darkness is getting relief thanks to three giant mirrors mounted on a nearby mountainside. Science World's Siri Nyrop has more.
The Norwegian industrial town of Rjukan sits in a narrow valley. Each year from September to March, the town of approximately 3,000 residents lives in perpetual shade. But the mirrors installed on the mountain wall, about 450 meters above the town, are designed to catch the sun's rays and reflect them onto the town. Residents of Rjukan gathered in the town square this past Wednesday as the three mirrors were activated. The reflected light is nearly as bright as direct sunlight. The mirror moves to follow the sun's path during the entire year. The mirror will be guided by wireless computer communication from the square below. A local resident and artist, Martin Andersen, conceived the idea, but it was first floated back in 1913 by a factory worker. A local industrialist considered the idea, but opted instead for a gondola that could carry sun-starved residents up to the mountaintops for a dose of natural light. The gondola is still in use, but local officials say they hope their new mirrors will attract more visitors. For Science World, I'm Siri Nyrop.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
The remains of prehistoric creatures such as saber-toothed cats are still being found at the La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles, California, 100 years after scientists first began their excavations. Elizabeth Lee tells us that scientists are now examining some of these fossils for clues about climate change.
In the heart of Los Angeles, surrounded by tall buildings and traffic, there are pools of black, bubbling tar. Scientists come here to unearth some unconventional treasure buried under this tar.
I get excited about a mouse toe.
Shelley Cox cleans fossils in a lab called the Fishbowl. It is located in the George C. Page Museum in Los Angeles, which houses fossils of animals and plants trapped and preserved by the tar at the La Brea Tar Pits. Some of the remains date back more than 40,000 years.
We have such a variety of fossils that there is almost something for everyone preserved right here.
That's 5.5 million fossils found in the last 100 years, and it's why paleontologists from around the world come here to study the discoveries. Chief Curator John Harris says even saber-toothed cats and mammoths were no match for the thick, sticky asphalt.
They got stuck in asphalt, stuck like flies on flypaper, and if they were lucky, they succumbed to hunger and thirst after about a week. If they were unlucky, they were torn apart by wandering predators and scavengers.
In the past, paleontologists focused on the large mammals, but the remains of smaller creatures, such as snails or insects, are now getting more attention. These microfossils give scientists a better picture of the ancient ecosystem. They also tell scientists how organisms are affected by climate change. Unlike the extinct large mammals, the descendants of these smaller creatures still exist but do not necessarily live in the same area as their ancestors.
Well, if we have some idea of how life changes when we have changes in climate, then we can take precautions when we're actually undergoing those same climatic changes ourselves.
Scientists say the plants and animals preserved in TAR can tell them how global warming in the past affected ancient organisms and can help them understand which species may be the most vulnerable as the temperatures rise in the modern world. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
You think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Let's find out. This week, we wanted to know what, according to the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society, was the highest temperature ever recorded on Earth. Was it A, 60 degrees, B, 53.5 degrees, or C, 56.7 degrees Celsius? The answer is C. The highest temperature ever recorded on Earth was 56.7 degrees Celsius. On October 7, 1913, using a regulation Weather Bureau thermometer shelter with a maximum thermometer graduated to 135 degrees Fahrenheit, the record high was set at Furnace Creek Ranch in Death Valley, California. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Back in April, President Obama unveiled a new program called the Brain Initiative, which was described as a bold new research effort to revolutionize our understanding of the human mind and uncover new ways to treat, prevent, and cure brain disorders like Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, autism, epilepsy, and traumatic brain injury. While medical science has made incredible strides in a wide range of areas, there is still much more to learn about the supercomputer in our head. The brain. This week, researchers from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine said that they found that a type of brain cells called dendrites that was thought to only serve as a kind of wiring system does much more. These cells actually help the brain boost its computing power. Dr. Spencer Smith led the research, and he joins us for today's one-on-one segment to tell us more about his team's research and findings. First of all, Dr. Smith, since the research you led seemed to focus on them, my first question is, what is a dendrite before and after your research?
Okay, so a dendrite is one of the two types of branches from a neuron. One type of branch is the axon, and that's where the spikes travel out to give the output from the neuron to other neurons or muscles to make them move. The other branch of a neuron is the dendrite, and that's the part that I studied, and that's typically where neurons receive their input in. And we used to think of these branches as sort of passive conductors or wires kind of connecting the upstream neurons to the downstream neurons, conducting those inputs. What this study shows is that in vivo, in a regular behaving animal, a crucial component of brain function is to actually have those individual branches process some of the information actively. And so they're not passive wires, they actually can act like transistors.
When I hear this, the first thing that comes to mind, Dr. Smith, is a person overclocking his computer. Is that a decent comparison? Is this something that happens occasionally, or is this just a regular part of how the brain functions?
Well, it's something that can definitely be modulated. So For some types of behavior, there may be less dendritic spiking than in other types of behavior. And so in that way, you can modulate how much processing is happening in the dendrites. And this is also going to depend neuron to neuron. But it is something, of course, that the brain's always been doing. We just got some good evidence to show that it's happening so that we know it now. Like to think that our understanding of the brain now has to include this larger processing capacity, this larger computational capacity. But it's always been there. We're just now coming to terms with it.
Your experiments were quite interesting. I understand you even built a special tool for the experiments. Can you tell us about them?
So two-photon microscopes are a tool that we use to look at the brain in living animals. So it's special in that it can see deep inside the brain. And unlike MRI that some people may be more familiar with, this modality actually gives us very, very fine resolution, about at least 1,000 times greater resolution than what you can get with MRI. And so we can see tiny little portions of neurons rather than just big chunks of brain tissue like you do in MRI. And so with this tool, we can actually see the dendrites. We can see that our pipette is on a dendrite. And we can also look at the calcium signals that are nearby where we've attached onto that dendrite. And so it's a powerful tool in order to explore dendritic processing. It was important to develop this tool and to really make it work well, because these are very challenging experiments. To get one of these recordings is tremendously difficult. And this was one of the major roadblocks and the reason why this research wasn't done, 20 years ago. So I spent a lot of time trying to optimize our tools and techniques so that we could make these recordings.
From what I understand in your research, Dr. Smith, that you had this pipette hooked up to a mouse's brain, and you were feeding it, I guess, visual stimulation. They were seeing something, and then as a result, you saw the spikes as it reacted to the visual stimulation?
Yes, that's exactly right. And we've known for a long time that neurons in the visual cortex will spike in response to visual stimuli that have different orientations. So if you imagine just black and white bars, if those black and white bars are horizontal, some neurons will respond and fire spikes, and other neurons won't. And then if they're, say, vertical, then a different population of neurons will fire spikes and others won't. And that sensitivity to the orientation of the lines is something that happens in cortex, in the outer layers of the brain, which is where we were studying. It doesn't happen upstream of cortex. And so this was a computation that we could look at. We needed to know some sort of computation that these cells are doing so that we can pick the right stimuli and record the right responses and be able to infer whether or not these dendritic spikes were contributing to that computation.
I'm quite curious from your research, Dr. Smith, how will the findings of your team's research allow scientists to better understand and perhaps develop new ways to treat various neurological disorders?
Well, we don't have a very good understanding of how the brain works on a large scale, and particularly the subcellular mechanisms that can give rise to large-scale brain functions. For example, in autism and schizophrenia, we really don't have a very good grasp on what the underlying pathology is. So any basic neuroscience that we can do to illuminate how the brain functions can be very useful for that type of research. So what we do in my lab, actually, we have mouse models of autism and schizophrenia. And these are mice that have been genetically engineered to have the same genetic mutations that are linked to human disease. And so we don't say that the mice are autistic or have schizophrenia, but if they have the same mutation that we see in humans, we can look to see what that does in general to mammalian circuitry. And once we can understand what goes wrong, then that can give us insights into what goes wrong in humans. And then that can give us new ideas about different therapeutic strategies or drug targets that we can develop.
That was Dr. Spencer Smith from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.